Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon on the West Coast and good evening on the East Coast. I'm Oscar Crawford from Oscar Crawford Media, being joined again today by Audra Michelle in Florida. We have been talking for the past couple of weeks about what it means to be a narcissist, narcissistic behavior. And on our last time together, we talked about unconditional love. We hope you're excited about the information that we're sharing and learning some things that will be practical in your life. Stay tuned. We're going to go a little deeper today. Audra Michelle, are you hooked up with me?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm really glad that we're together again. And
me too.
I'm finding that people are asking me questions that I'm going to throw at you from jump. Are you ready?
That sounds good.
Okay, so people are beginning to ask if we might go back and review a bit about what exactly is a narcissist and what makes a narcissist different from a person who's just conceited. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, everybody's got some basic narcissism in them. That's a characteristic of any species is to have a hopefully a good inflated ego, not inflated, but an ego of yourself and confidence. Everyone's got some narcissism, but when it's an overwhelming trait where it's all pervasive, it becomes a pathology, and that's all you are, is the narcissism, and it becomes almost a delusionary state where you need to consistently change the view of things that are going on so that you can view yourself at a higher and higher level. And at that point, there's no seeing anything but that, and the person underneath is so broken they can never be found again. So it's basically when somebody is an all-pervasive pathology that affects every single area of their life, in which they need to live in constant delusionary states in order to make their opinion of themselves reach a level that is higher than what they consider elite.
Okay, and so is there a common background and experience that drives an individual to be a narcissist?
Well, there's different things that come into play, but the main way that it's caused is basically when you're before 7 years of old, when you're not put in, given self-worth, it's never created. And in the case of a narcissism, which usually involves physical abuse, because it tends to be the type of abuse that causes the pathology, and there's a physical abuse to it. And so there's so much just self-hate that they delude themselves into feeling like a different person in order to feel, you know, acceptable and worthwhile. But there's so much overwhelming hate underneath it all. And basically that's how it's created. And then there's also where children are overly smothered or overly watched, where they're told basically that they're a god and they just never kind of grow out of that stage. So those are the two main ways that it started.
Okay, and is there any such thing as a high-functioning narcissist whose behavior may be more acceptable in relationship than another?
Well, basically, you made the yearly psychological books that say that narcissism is a scale now. This is the first year that they said it. So at the low end, you have narcissistic tendencies, which I don't know. I haven't met anybody that fits a narcissist, just has tendencies, but, you know, that's only my personal knowledge. But the DSM says that they start with traits, and then the center of it is a malignant narcissist, and then the extreme is a sociopathic narcissist.
Okay, and the sociopath,
what's
going on there?
You know, they get more. Well, there's just tendencies. The narcissism is just a textbook, you know, the textbook list of characteristics that somebody possesses. And so as they start off, I guess, on the tendency side, they just have some of the characteristics in the center. They're basically a textbook of a narcissist. In the extreme end, they tend to lack conscience. So basically a malignant narcissist and a sociopathic narcissist will probably participate in the same activities. The only difference is a narcissist will tend to take everything that he does, no matter how wrong it is, and rationalize it to fit his his morals. So he does have morals. He just fits in these behaviors that they fit the morals. Or a sociopathic narcissist doesn't have the conscience, so they're not so much reaffirming them their own, you know, acceptability. There's no moral compass to go by. And an example of that is, you know, basically textbook narcissists will cheat. And they, if you ask them if they cheat, they'll swear up and down to God they do not cheat. And the reason being is because they have convinced themselves in their own mind that it doesn't count. So when they cheat, they have what's called the angel and devil or angel and slut theory. So they have their angel, and that's their, you know, baby, their girlfriend or their wife. And then everyone else that they cheat with is just a slut, so they don't count. So if you ask them if they cheat, they'll tell you they don't cheat, but they're not lying because they believe they don't cheat. And that way they can sit their moral fist and they can say that they go by the morals. They just have to delude themselves to believe that their actions fit in those moral guidelines.
Okay, so are narcissists always violent towards the person they are in relationship with?
Violent physically?
Yes.
I would say the sociopathic, you know, and narcissists are, but the more sociopathic they become, the more physical violent they are. Violent mentally and verbally, yes, definitely. That's kind of a typical trait, basically, when you think of the textbook definition of abuser, though not all abusers are narcissists. The narcissist's base is what an abuser is. I mean, almost in most
okay.
cases of it. But there's a lot of people that abuse and aren't narcissists as well.
Okay. So another question that I got since we talked last was, how does a man or woman who's involved with a narcissist develop ways to become tolerant of their behavior and accept them? Because some people heard us talk about that in the context of unconditional love. You know, they're not going to change. The only thing you can change is your behavior to be able to manage staying with them and being functional with them.
Mm-hmm.
What are the approaches to learning how to do that?
To learning how to deal with their – I don't think that
– Yes.
You know, for me, it's hard for me to say. I think that, you know, a lot of people would have to be out of the situation in order to educate themselves and to comprehend what's good while you're in the situation. There's just no way to comprehend anything to that extreme or to separate yourself out of the situation enough to see things as you learn them. So I don't know if in the relationship that you're in, I mean, just from my own experience, I can't see myself understanding things the way I do while I was in the situation. You know, I think that now it's years and years and years later, I can see things as I do. And now when I am in a situation around someone that's narcissistic, I'm able to definitely understand their motives and their thoughts and accept them as they are. But I don't think I could have done that while I was in the relationship, not to a level that would keep me feeling as if I have my own confidence and control and it can't be taken away. Because I mean, even with myself, it can be, and it's not a really applicable situation for someone to assume that they can take that on and live in a situation and become able to accept it. It's just not very practical, even though they want to, because anything seems better than leaving. You know, if there's a way to stay, then they want to stay, and that just has to do with the codependency and the abuse cycle. But it's not, you know, even myself, with all the knowledge I have, I couldn't put myself back in the situation and not become a codependent again. Codependency, you don't recover from it. It's an ongoing addiction that you filter your behaviors through. So you have your codependent behaviors, and you take the knowledge that you gain and you filter every behavior to it. And there's amazing ways that you fit codependent behaviors that are natural to you. So when you learn a healthy viewpoint, you have to filter all your behaviors through that, and then they come out well. And then after a while, it becomes more and more natural, but the codependent's still there. So even myself, I can't put myself back in a situation like that and expect to not become a victim again, because I will. So I can't say that, you know, they can now, you know, they can basically accept the behaviors and see things, you know, try to see things as non-abusive, but I don't see them being successful in doing so. I mean, it's a matter of a statement of you can stay and be abused or you can leave, but I don't suggest trying to stay that in any means necessary.
Okay, so let's go a little further then. What is the probability of once one steps out of that relationship or that kind of relationship
one
to begin
step?
To work on?
What did you? I'm sorry, I missed the question.
No. I'm asking the question. When
mm-hmm.
one steps out of that kind of relationship and wants to begin to work on themselves to do some practical forms of healing, what is the likelihood that that person is able to then move on to other relationships after that?
Well, I have to say that leaving the relationship is a much harder percentage than anything that you could do after the relationship. I mean, just getting out of the relationship makes you, I think I've heard the statistic about 1 in 10, will ever, first of all, leave a relationship, but more so identify that they have any kind of pathology or something that they need to work on, this codependency, because it's an addiction or any pathology, it's an addiction with no start date. There's no day you started doing heroin. There's no day you started doing sex. It's all you've ever known since the day you've been born. Before you spoke words, you heard words that you turned in, that were abusive and damaged yourself. So it's something that from the day you first speak, you're speaking codependency. So it's no way. That's the hardest part, I think, is to recognize your own issues. You can say that this person abused you and this person, but why were you susceptible to it? I think the hardest thing in that would be to identify that you have a pathology and to work on that. And I'd have to say that if you're going to do so successfully, you need years and years. I mean, I still, you know, this is 10 years for me, and I still meet everybody that I have any kind of minor interest in. I'm very careful because I can see the narcissism pretty quickly, but I need to associate that and to recognize that. And this, thus far, to this day, everyone that I find myself attracted to is the same narcissistic personality. And so I have to be very careful and don't get into relationships. But I know that if I was, and I was with somebody that I always seem to find, is it would be worse. So I'm very, very much acceptable with being alone. And that doesn't give people, you know, a good outlook. But I'll tell you, when you're at this point and you have the knowledge, that's actually a beautiful outlook, that you can be alone and you can be okay with that. I mean, I'd much rather be alone, because being with someone else has always been way more lonely.
Okay, I really do hear your heart talk there. So one of the things that we both know is that people tend to, you know, go straight into another relationship, whether or not they've done any work on the one they just got out of or not. So I fully understand why taking time.
That's codependency.
Of course.
And that's narcissism too. Narcissism and codependency, they both need, the other person involved, the other part of their crazy zone, you know, the other part of their, you know, social makeup. So they tend to constantly, and it's called a pattern of behavior for a reason, because it's continuous. And if you date again, you'll end up in again. So you need to heal yourself, because you have to be whole before you can be half.
I hear you. But it sounds like a dance between what's generally known as anger and depression, right? Depression.
I don't know if I think those feelings are more something that you can tell that you're depressed. You can tell that you're angry. There's more ways to see it, but the pattern of behavior isn't an emotion. It's your every action. It's the way you walk. It's the way you talk. It's the way you do everything that you do. So it's not something that's an emotion that you could grasp. It's not tangent. Something way, way bigger than that. And so, you know, when you are somebody who's a victim, 90% of the time, I would assume you're codependent. And you need to associate that, because, you know, oh, he's a jerk and getting away, that's great. But you're just going to end up with another person like that. If you look back at your history, that's all you've ever been with. And there's a reason why. And so you need to identify something that is completely and totally normal to you. And it's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, no, I know. That's the reason I want to make the point about the dance between anger and depression. When I work with people who suffer either end of that spectrum, if somebody's presenting anger issues to me, I want to know what they dream. If somebody's presenting to me depression issues, I want to know what they dream, because that tends to be a continuous circle and cycle of the same behavior, whether one's acting it out on someone else or acting it out on themselves. It has the same orientation that nobody really knows how they got. They just know that they wound up. It's not like PTSD. Somebody comes home from the war from PTSD and is affected
right.
by PTSD.
It's
an event.
It's the first word you speak. It's all you know. It's all you understand.
Well, It becomes your only filter through which you process your living experience. It becomes all you know.
I mean, it's not even a filter, because the filter you can put in there and alter your perception. It is your perception. So a filter would go in there to skew your view or to unskew your view. In my case, unskew it, you know, and so the perception is there. That's all you know. You can put a filter in there, but it's no filter. It's all there is. it's be up before any filter could be applied. If you can put a filter in there, you can be a hell of a lot healthier for it. But, you know, to identify that is remarkable. And that is something that after worrying about, you know, after you leave the relationship, all these things and what, you know, how long, when it comes to that, if you can do that, then you've got a really good future, you know, potential there. And without it, you're just going to be the same forever.
I understand. I fully understand what you see. And I am agreeing to the extent that my practice with people with the symptoms that you present and describe have been limited. They may have even been more affected by what you described than I was aware of. What I am clear about is that there is some behavior modification that can go on with people who suffer anger issues and depression issues and even some PTSD, but either of them have the same orientation that you're describing. Now, are you really saying that being codependent is the same as – no, I'm asking, are you suggesting that the illness of the codependent is just a reciprocal of being a narcissist, that a narcissist needs a codependent personality?
No. I would say they are, you know, psychological soulmates, one and one go in hand. And from what I've heard four to one codependence for every abuser. You know, there's so many more codependents because mental abuse is so much more common than physical. No, I wouldn't say it's a reciprocal because there's also borderline, there's also histrionic. There's a lot of different pathologies that present and different things that come up. So there's a whole, you know, pond of fish. So I wouldn't say there's one that's an opposite of another, but they call it a dance of two people that's crazy. Without one, the other can't be there. So they do go hand in hand, but I wouldn't say they're definite, you know, that they're really, you know, opposites or anything of the sort. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, the codependents, they're very manipulative too. I mean, they might be thinking they're doing it for somebody else's own good, but whatever the case may be, they might be trying to help people, whatever they may say. They have different characteristics that are similar as well. Not that they're abusive, but they can be very manipulative. There's different things like that. They're not just the good people. You know, there's different things that come into being a codependent that you learn as you get better. But, they definitely live in the pocket together, but I don't really think they live in opposite pockets.
Okay. I was clear about from listening to your talk that the codependent strategy would have to deal with developing one's manipulative skills to have some sense of getting what they want out of their connection.
But I think the difference is that, you know, when you're codependent, yeah, I mean, you have to manipulate, but that comes after all, and I wouldn't say with your mate, because you could stay, and I'm sure I wouldn't be the person to tell you exactly how to install it when you're in the relationship. I can only tell you from my own experiences, and that would be after leaving the relationship and not going back to it and planning to never go back to it. So that's where my views come from. As for being, you know, I can, when it comes to working with my ex-husband, when it comes to, you know, the people in my life that I have to deal with because I have a son, there's a way in order to learn knowledge of the way that a narcissist thinks in order to work with them better. And in some way that is manipulative. I mean, maybe I'm speaking his language so that he can comprehend me, or maybe I'm, handling objections before they occur, whatever the case may be, to someone to their own mind in a way that is always manipulation. But it's hard for me, you know, all the advice I give you, you know, all the words I say, that's the way they come from. I'm not speaking to somebody who's planning on staying in a relationship because I really wouldn't know what to advise them on. I only know what to advise on after if you don't go or after you leave. Definitely, if that's your frame of mind, if you don't want to be in a really abusive relationship, that's the knowledge I have. So it's really difficult. But there are people that do know about things like that, and it's all about knowledge, and, you know, you can learn about that stuff. There's a lot of different online, you know, professionals that, you know, there's one, you know, manipulating the narcissist, or, you know, there's a lot of different things where you can stay in relationship, and there's information for you, but that's not where I'd be a good source for it.
No. Here's the other thing that I'm pursuing now as we're talking. So everybody you meet that would either you sense an interest in that person, or you sense the person senses an interest in you, your whole matrix for approach to connection goes into full gear almost before somebody says hello? I mean, is it that acute for you? And do you think that's what happens to everybody who's been through what you've been through?
No, definitely not, because they don't even know that they haven't, you know, a pathology, or that they just have someone mean to them. You know, they don't really, you know, grasp it. This is a lot of knowledge. I mean, for me to be able to identify, and it's definitely not, there's people that I don't identify. A lot of people I can identify really quick, and there's some people that, you know, I don't see it. You know, I have, you know, as soon as I sense an instinct, I know. But, you know, I don't really know what I'm feeling, but I have the instinct. If someone is acting a certain way and I'm feeling, I know the feeling of abuse better than any other thing I can imagine. So when I'm being abused, whether I can understand how or what, I feel abused. And I go with my instincts and my initial actions, and I always find out that I was right. But it's very, you know, I don't try to, even when you're talking to someone, you know, you're a codependent. So I can easily fall back into my tracks in 5-10 minutes of talking to somebody. No matter how much knowledge you gain, you're still going to be susceptible to it. So it's very hard from your own point of view to see it. Now I kind of feel it. If I don't see it right away and I begin to speak with someone more regularly, I have to go with because my knowledge will be overwhelmed and with my codependency coming back. So it's, you know, the combination is very, very vital.
Well, I was sharing this with someone yesterday that whenever I come home and I'm talking to my wife about a woman that I've met that I'm excited about, she will look at me and inevitably say, "Baby, take time to get to know them." And the reason she mm-hmm. does that is because she knows that she's my filter for observing women, especially as if I would get to know a woman to become her friend or work with her or do something like that, because she believes that I'm so sensitive to what people really are like, and after I get to know them, I probably won't like them. And so I think we probably all got some radar or some operation going on out of our minds that kind of
yes.
help us get information, whether people actually speak it to us or not. But I got to tell you, 100% of the time she's been right. 100%
well,
of the time.
Well, you know, we all have the instincts. They are natural. They are just more natural to us than our behaviors. I mean, that's all that exists. But we have to be able to identify them. And identifying and living on instinct is an art that takes years and years to develop. It's so worthwhile. But, you know, you always have. I remember with my ex, you know, we would be watching a movie and he would cuddle, but he wouldn't cuddle. I remember wondering why, like, it seemed so robotic, which is I never had that thought in my life or heard of anything like that, but it seemed robotic and cold, you know, where I would hug and then hug tight, or I would, you know, move my hand around to, like, massage or whatever the case may be. But he was very, you know, it was a very strange feeling, and I remember thinking that, but now I would say, okay, there is an instinct, I need to do this. But at the time, I still to this day remember that exact moment and could see myself on the couch watching the movie and feeling that, but I couldn't have identified it then or known what, even if I did, I wouldn't have known what it meant. So, you know, yeah, we all do have that, but becoming, you know, understanding of what our instincts are and what they mean and that they exist and what they, when you feel that it is an instinct, that is something that you have to learn.
All right, let's shift a bit. I want to push another question at you just for some consideration. So when people talk to us about being our authentic selves, in your view, is that a possibility?
Yes.
Discovering who you are authentically?
I think that if there's an authentic self, I think that, you know, that we all have an authentic self, whether that's the real self or not, is something different. Now, if we're being authentic and we're in a complete codependent stage, we're still being real, but what was real as who we are is might be completely different than who we'd be if we weren't codependent. So I think the person that I am and being authentic now, this person as I am 10 years later, I was never not real. I was real. I was who I was. But now this person later is a whole, you know, different person with many, many levels to her. And, you know, so being real is basically being yourself and being honest and things like that. But, you know, the authentic self, that was buried way underneath for me, and I wouldn't have even known, you know, what, you know, that she existed. But I don't think I was any less real, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. It's the same thing I've always said to you about your writing. I know no
mm-hmm.
one who can capture more feeling in words than you. And it's equal to what you just shared with me that I sense is your level of clarity. You have a level of clarity that most people are never going to get there. You are clear. You're clear on what you're available to and open to and very clear about what you're not. And that's not something you really can teach. You can have conversations with people about it, but you really can't teach that. But you embody it.
I think there's so many ways besides just learning the abuse and learning about instinct and learning. I just constantly learn and about different kind of things so that I can bring that out. Now I think I'm more that, you know, my writing is, since I call myself a plagiarizer, because I just type and then edit like these feelings and these thoughts. I don't even know who writes them. I'm the typist and they come from some deep subconscious level in me. So in a lot of ways, I don't even write it. But as I read it now, they are my points of view. Whereas before they were lessons or they were things that I had to learn about myself or understand. Now I might not write them in that I just type out the words, but I can say, oh, that made sense because I feel this way or I've learned, you know, this and that. So I think the more I can identify myself in them more, because I guess I exist now more, but it doesn't, you know, there's it's not so much lessons I'm learning. I might not write them, but they're just deeper thoughts of what I realize I know now.
Well, listen, I got to say that's kind of where I am too. And I certainly don't think of myself as competent in capturing feelings as well as you do. But what I write usually just comes at once, and then I have to try and sort it enough to get it out so that I can go back and do what you're talking about. And I don't want to call it editing yet, but to go back and work out whatever I thought the intention of the message was that I'm supposed to transmit the paper or however I get it out. But it's much the same. I cannot account for where I get what I get. I just know I get it, and I'm glad.
That's an artist, but I can say that you might not know where the thoughts come from. I can't even write the topic. If I sat down and said, I'm going to write about this, I'm going to write about this feeling, there's nothing that's going to come out. So every time I type, I never know what I'm going to feel or present, ever.
Well, the only way I've gotten around that, because I don't do so well at that either. Like somebody will say, why don't you, somebody said to me on Instagram a week ago, how about writing something about dating an older adult? And I'm saying, okay, what are you looking for? You know, that's all they gave me. And so I can't just sit down and do that. But what I do is when
you
things
and I
come to me, I make
heart.
Notes.
You don't write a researched article where you're saying you don't have to give credit. It's your feelings and your overpowering, emotions. So when you're writing about yourself and your own views, it's a little bit different. Now, you could write a piece if you went and researched it and learned about this and, tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them what you told them, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's something that we write from the heart, then it's not the same thing.
Right. Agreed. And, if I get a choice of which I'd rather do, I certainly am much more engaged in what comes to me than I am when I've got to.
One's work and one's passion. There's a very big difference.
Oh, truly, truly. Okay. So we're going to do this again next week. And next week, maybe we'll take a moment and tell people the kinds of work you've been doing over the years. As model, as writer, and even as a business person. Let's let people get to know you a bit like that. And we'll continue this conversation because if it's benefiting nobody, it's benefiting me.
Yeah, and I enjoy it. I always enjoy talking to you anyway. I would do it for any reason, so it worked that well.
Listen, the lady I interviewed
yesterday. And we do this. We do this on the phone. We could just be talking on the phone and we'll talk.
Well, I know,
but go ahead.
It's our same conversation wherever we're doing it, whether it's for radio or just talking to each other. A lady I interviewed yesterday who's written a book called The Roar, she says she lives in some place called Wesley Chapel. Does that ring a bell to you?
Yeah, I'm really bad with directions, but it's not far from me. I think it's about 40 minutes away somewhere.
Well, it was blowing my mind that I've got interviews this week, and both of you live you live in Tampa. I think she lives outside Tampa. And I said,
Wesley Chapel is right out. I think it might be right outside or right on the border of Tampa.
Okay. Well, I love you. I appreciate all this time I'm getting to spend
me
with you.
Me too.
And we'll pick it.
Me too.
We'll pick it up again next Tuesday. Take care.
Thank you, Oscar. Bye-bye.